Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, what do you like to put in your witch's brew?
A little frog leg.
Yeah.
Rosemary.
Yeah.
Roasted garlic.
Yeah.
Of course. A little crystallized ginger.
Ooh, nice touch.
Yeah.
I highly recommend... Scale of Dragon, mm-hmm. Tooth of Wolf, mm-hmm. Witch's Mummy, Mongulf, Off the Raven, Sea Salt Shark, Root of Hemlock, Digged in the Dark, of course. Liver of a Blaspheming Jew, if you can get it, and Gall of Goat, Slips of Yew, and of course, you want all the Silvered in the Moon's Eclipse. That's just an old recipe that I picked up from...
You're such a purist.
Picked up from old Will there, but...
See, I just get my stuff from Trader Joe's, and you're all... Of the earth.
The witch's aisle at Trader Joe's is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything from your Scale of Dragon to, the Eye of Newt and Baboon's Blood.
Yeah, they have excellent Baboon's Blood. You know, this is what I love about How Stuff Works is that we can discuss these things. We've got our own coven here, and it really allows us to exchange ideas about witchcraft.
There's a coven at How Stuff Works?
Yeah.
Are you, like, seriously? Literally there's a coven at How Stuff Works? Or are you just talking about we... Throw ideas into a cauldron.
Oh, no. Yeah, sure. It was just metaphorical.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure, of course. There's not a real coven. That would be weird. No. It's metaphorical.
All right. Well.
Really.
Well, I would imagine you must be meeting in a separate space because as we know from legends and myth and folk tales, the classic version of the witch, and by the classic version of the witch, I'm not craning this in on Wiccan stuff, like in modern witches, of whom I know some. My friend Michelle is a practicing Wiccan, and to my knowledge, she does not have a cauldron.
No. Today we're talking about the witches that are burned in our memories.
And sometimes at stakes.
Pointy hats. Yeah, stakes.
Who have cauldrons, who are meeting in the dark, who are plotting against Macbeth, that are casting spells, that are hanging out with cats.
That hate Dorothy.
Mm-hmm. That are dying underneath the weight of houses that fall from the sky. This sort of thing. The idea of the witch is pretty fascinating, especially when you get past sort of the typical Halloween idea of just cackling old crones. I mean, we could just talk for a long time about the, about what the witch represents. Because as I've discussed before, I mean, the witch is basically a monster. The hag especially, you see the hag as a monster or the ogress, appearing throughout different myth cycles where, and some of this is tied to the idea that some sort of cannibalistic, grotesque old woman will come and eat your children if they don't behave.
Right.
Or that if you're not careful, guys, you might be seduced by what seems like a beautiful woman, but turns out to be a grotesque monster.
Right. Then sort of the succubus thing too.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then when you, and I mean, you also, in The Witch, you have a situation where it's a woman with power. And of course, that is a very interesting idea. Throughout a predominantly male-dominated culture, where suddenly here are women and they have power, and what does this power mean? Is it a threat to male dominance? And I mean, make me stop because I could keep going.
Well, I was going to say that Erica Jong has an interesting perspective on this from a historical context, and she has a book called Witchcraft and some poetry, some fiction, and some historical data in there.
Yeah, a few spells in the back.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I hope so. I think that she actually sort of approached this book in that manner of like, wow, could I become a witch myself? Even though, she's someone who I think is grounded in reality and knows that she wasn't necessarily going to start flying around. But anyway, she is the author of Fear of Flying. That's what she's best known of as, in her foreword of the book, she says, witchcraft in Europe and America is essentially this hearkening back to female divinity within a patriarchal culture. If you insist long enough that God is the father, a nostalgia for the mother goddess will be born. If you exclude women from church rites, they will practice their magic in the fields, in forests, in their own kitchens. The point is, female power cannot be suppressed. It can only be driven underground.
Huh.
So this is how she places witches really in a historical sense of, okay, what's actually happening here when we talk about witches, when we get away from this idea of pointy hats and broomsticks, even though broomsticks certainly play into it, as we will find out.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned the necessary reemergence of the feminine deity, because I'm reminded of a series of essays that I read, and if I'd known that you were going to go in this direction, I would have brought that book with me. I'll have to put something on the blogs about it. But there's some interesting material in there about depictions of Jesus Christ in medieval art, and in some of these depictions, Christ becomes more and more feminine. And you actually have varying, in some cases outright heretical, and I'm doing quotes with air quotes in my fingers here, heretical ideas, or sometimes they're just sort of quasi-heretical, where individuals end up worshiping a more female version of Christ in the same way that there are female depictions of the Buddha.
Okay, so this is sort of in an effort to unify, right?
Right.
To bring both sides to this doctrine.
Right, and to focus more on feminine aspects, in this case, of Jesus, and then to venerate those aspects as opposed to just bleeding man-god on a tree kind of a thing. It's a really fascinating subject because you get into this whole interesting area of the wound of Christ, the spear wound, and how this spear wound is also kind of like a vagina.
Oh, it's right.
I mean, it's fascinating
stuff. There.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going to be strong. That's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The wound is like vagina.
Yeah. Next time you see an image of Doubting Thomas, think about that. But moving on, side tangent there, but back to witches. You were saying.
Yeah. Erica Jong, though, she does explore the reasons why we have vilified witches throughout the ages. And one of the things that she says really interesting is that women have always been the bearers of life, right?
Right.
And we know historically women have been repressed on all sorts of different fronts. She also says that as women gain power, they begin to sort of be tamped down. And if you ascribe witchness to someone, or you put power in the light of negativity, then what you're doing essentially is saying that not only is this person a life bringer, a life bearer, which is really powerful, but this person has the ability to bring death, right? Through potions, magic, general dark shenanigans, right?
Yeah. And if they're engaged in food preparation too, I mean, that's
right.
Food can be the big life giver, but if something's wrong with it, that if it becomes toxic in some way, shape or form, if something goes off, if there's some sort of bacterial infection, then it's a killer as well.
That's right. That's why you should always be kind to your server, right?
Yeah.
You never know what's going on in the kitchen.
She might be a witch.
Yep. She might be a witch, or he might be, right?
Yeah.
A warlock. So it's going to sound flip to say this, but all of a sudden you've got something like a broom, which becomes really important and almost like a very high tech object in the 13th century. Right.
Which is interesting because I think the broom is something we often discount as that very Halloween idea of a witch. Like mm-hmm. you've got a, you know, there's like a kindergartner. Let's put a funny nose on her, paint her face green, give her a broom, and she can start collecting candy.
Right. Striped tights.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is important to understand that this really was a prized object in
yeah.
the home. And we talk about the kitchen and who's preparing your food. We're also talking about the person who has, you know, usually elaborately braided broom. A cauldron, right, that mm-hmm. may have been passed down from generation to generation. And these objects start to really gain importance.
Yeah, they are key feminine cultural artifacts.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you start to think about a witch, you start to think about brooms, it would make sense that somehow they would factor into the image of a witch. But now you'll look at early typographs of witches, and you'll often see some depictions of witches quite naked.
Yeah.
On top of a stride.
Exceedingly naked. And that's another thing that, old Will Shakespeare, well, no, I don't know if they were naked if there's any reference to the naked in the text. I'm thinking of Roman Polanski's version of Macbeth.
Which was certainly naked.
Which is awesome and has some really naked old witches in it.
Yeah.
Which I thought worked perfectly.
But,
and calls back to these old engravings and woodcuts where you see
right.
naked women flying around in the middle of the night, talking with goats. Riding goats, in engaging with the devil in various ways, shapes, and form.
Right. And turns out there's something to this, right? Where if you scratch the surface a little bit, you'll find out that the broom actually figures pretty prominently in witches' work. And let's just back up real quick. Yes, the broom is the ultimate symbol of domesticity, but if in the hands of a witch, it can become this really potent symbol of liberation, right?
Right.
And the more disenfranchised a person is, the more that they might turn to magical thinking to gain some sort of mastery over their situation. So let's look at it this way. Maybe someone wasn't necessarily a self-proclaimed witch,
mm-hmm.
but perhaps they did dabble back in the day, you know, when we're talking about this historical witch. You know, 13th century, in ointments because it was important for healing, in ritual and magical spells because this was a way to gain some sort of control over their lives.
Right.
But back to this broom.
The broom. Yeah. There's kind of like two interesting ways of looking at the power of the broom. One, which we'll discuss even more, is, of course, the magical thinking side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this whole ointment situation.
Ointment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which you think is a gross word, but...
I do. And now we're about to really sort of... dive into the fly in the ointment here and talk about something that's very interesting about the broom in the ointment. You want to run with that?
Okay, so there's this idea that witches, they're flying around on broomsticks or they're flying around in a chair, but in many of these tales and accusations, they are rubbing an ointment on the broom or chair first,
mm-hmm.
which is often glossed over. Generally, it's not a part of the Halloween costume.
No.
And so they're
usually not a jar of ointment accompanying
right.
the costume.
So they're taking this broom, they're coating it with some sort of mysterious ointment that they've brewed up,
mm-hmm.
and then they're riding this broomstick naked and just having a wonderful time doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, obviously that brings to mind some various scenarios that could be taking place. And there's actually some real, some people put some real thought into this and the idea that the ointment is in fact a drug or has a pharmaceutical or psychedelic properties,
mm-hmm.
and they are interacting with the ointment on the broom.
Yeah, there are some pharmacologists who say, you know what, we think that this is actually what was happening, is that these ointments were being made
mm-hmm.
and applied through the skin.
Basically applying a crazy pharmaceutical ointment to the genitals with a broomstick.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
In fact, they probably said that on the side. Apply gently to broomstick, then ride broomstick genitals first.
In Gothic font. And this is from the investigation of Lady Alice Keitler in 1324. She was one of the first women to be accused of witchcraft in Ireland. We have this account. Quote, in rifling the closet of the lady, they found a pipe of ointment wherewith she greased a staff upon which she ambled and galloped through thick and thin. Okay. I mean, these are the actual documents that they're pulling some of this stuff from.
And not that we put tremendous amount of stock in the prosecution's materials in witchcraft trials. I mean, they're...
No, true.
Take that with a whole lot of salt. But who knows? The idea that there could be some shred of truth to this is fascinating.
Okay. Dig a little deeper. And this is from the Journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists in a paper they call The Legacy of Atropos, The Fate Who Cut the Thread of Life, which I think is really poetic for a journal. In the paper, they describe a tome written by a 16th century Dutch physician, Johan Weir, who concluded that a plant called henbane was a principal ingredient in witches' brew, along with deadly nightshade and mandrake. And according to Weir, there were other ointments, but the essential ingredients remained the same in all of them. In all the preparations, when they applied to the upper thighs or genitals, it was said to induce the sensation of rising into the air and flying. And by the way, by applying this to their skin... And rather than taking it orally, it was much more effective because then they didn't have to digest this and have obviously the sort of stomach ailments that would accompany that.
Right.
So at some point they figured out that, hey, this is a pretty good way to get a high.
Well, it's similar in a way to the way some medications are applied via suppository rather than taken orally.
Yeah.
And one of the dangers with suppositories, if you're taking some sort of illicit substance, is of course that you can't, if you take it orally, you can become ill and vomit it back up. But, suppository, not so much.
Yeah. And for the people that were studying these ointments, they weren't necessarily thinking that that witches at that time were, applying them and then actually, you know, taking flight. They understood this to have hallucinatory properties. Back in the 16th century, Francis Bacon even said, the witches themselves are imaginative and believe oftentimes they do that which they do not, transforming themselves into other bodies, not by incantations or ceremonies, but by ointments and anointing themselves all over. So they had sort of an inkling there that, yes, they were transcending the experience, but not in physical body.
How
or not actually
dare
like,
they get together and have transcendental experiences and not invite the menfolk?
I know. And this is interesting, too. The use of soot, which is sort of alkaline, would have enhanced the passage of organic bases because a weak alkaline environment would be sufficient to neutralize the positive ionic charge. This is, again, from that anesthesiologist journal. This is an effective ethnobotanical technique that may be seen with Peruvian cocoa chewers who mix in their mouths the cocaine-containing leaves with alkaline cinders to enhance uptake.
And this is interesting, and a topic we'll probably go into in greater detail in a future podcast. But this is by far would not be the only situation of individuals taking some sort of psychedelic substance part of a ritual or magical practice.
Right, and don't you have an article on licking frogs? Or am I thinking of something else?
I have a pamphlet. It was handed to me by a guy on the train.
Okay, but that's...
I've been very trepidatious about trying it out.
There are some hallucinatory frogs that if you've licked... actually, I think it's maybe the venom or something.
Yeah.
That they have that people can actually get high. So obviously through trial and error over thousands of years, people have figured out different properties in plants and animals and manipulated them. So it's not weird that someone would come up with an ointment. And it's not weird that this person, this female in the family, would be the person to come up with these ointments that are you know, mostly healing, right?
Right.
And have a sort of power in their household, maybe even in their village, as the go-to person that has all these great little recipes that can make you feel a lot better, possibly make you feel as though you are riding a broom. And let's also talk about that broom. I hate to sort of bring it up, but again, you know, why not just the ointment? Why have the broom?
Right.
And I'm just going to point out that this perhaps was a proto-sexual aid back
in
the day.
So like a ye old-timey sex toy, basically.
Yeah.
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 Now, and I wonder too if like going back though from the side of women, liberated women engaging in a certain activity and looking instead at really grumpy men deciding to crack down on this and persecute women.
Right.
I wonder how much with the broom too, there's this idea of you have defiled, and not only have you defiled yourself and your faith and all, but you've also defiled this object which has sympathetic importance in the household and in the family.
Mm-hmm.
and also as a symbol of the status. And you've somehow perverted this artifact.
Well, also, as we know, the understanding of female sexuality certainly wasn't that complex or nuanced back in the day. And,
right.
And some would argue that today it still suffers.
We just did the podcast that dealt with the female orgasm.
Yeah,
and obviously, scientists are still figuring out exactly what human sexuality and female sexuality is all about.
Yeah, and so for a woman to express sexuality, certainly during one period over mm-hmm. another, depending on what was happening in the 13th century as opposed to the 16th century, there were certainly iconic images and ideals to live up to.
Yeah.
Well, I'll put it that way.
All right, so we've discussed the ointment-based importance of flying around on broomsticks and so forth. But after this break, we're going to really get into the idea of magical thinking and how that enforces all these things that we're talking about.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, so we're back.
Yeah, we've solved the broomstick problem here.
Yeah, and I want to add one more thing about the broomstick. I couldn't help but be reminded of the Baba Yaga, you know, the old Russian hag or witch or cannibalistic ogress, you know, with the tusks for teeth.
That one.
Yeah, she also shows up in there's a movie called Jack Frost, which Mystery Science Theater 3000 did years ago, and it has the Baba Yaga in it. So she's a really iconic character in Russian myth. And she's a witch, and she, in addition to living in a hut that walks around on hen's legs, she also flies through the air, sometimes in an iron kettle,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes in a mortar and pestle, which, of course, is the device for crushing up various herbs and what have you, and making them into powders for mm-hmm. use in ointments, for use in, and you go to the pharmacist today, and, I mean, that's the symbol of the craft.
Yeah, again, here are these symbols of domesticity, right? That are being harnessed for powerful goings on with witches, which I think is really interesting and really plays into this idea of the law of contagion, which is one of the two laws of sympathetic magic.
Yeah, sympathetic magic is this very old idea. The idea that if something, I think we've discussed this before. Okay, so I have a rubber dinosaur in my hand, all right?
It's true, you do.
And I have touched this rubber dinosaur, right?
Yeah.
And in touching it, I'm probably doing nothing more than getting some of my skin oil on it or my fingerprints, what have you, ink from my hands. My hands are really disgusting, aren't they? But then when I set it down, the taint of my touch, that'll be the extent of it. The idea of sympathetic magic is that there's an even greater taint that is applied to this rubber dinosaur and that I have somehow imbued it with a sense of myself.
You've transferred yourself to this object.
Right.
Yeah.
And we continue to do this sort of thing today. I mean, I'm just dealing with my own stuff. I'm wearing my dad's watch that he died in. I'm not a logical believer in sympathetic magic, but I am sympathetic towards this object, and I have, to a certain extent, imbued it with a sense of him on some level, you know? So, I mean, we all do this kind of thing every day.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit in The Science of Lucky Pants and, you know, how we ascribe meaning to things, and we think if I do this or if I take this, then, you know, something will happen. Or in the case of your father's watch, I mean, that is for you a part of him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that we're all sort of hardwired to have this sort of symbolism in our lives.
Right. And I should mention, I explained the watch. I didn't explain why I have a rubber dinosaur in my hand. And it's a squeeze toy that I use to keep from fidgeting too much while recording a podcast. Just to explain that. Why I have a rubber dinosaur on my person.
It's true. He squeezes the heck out of it.
Yeah.
And that's fine, right?
Another idea that arises from sympathetic magic is like the idea that you can treat a weapon to treat the wound, or somehow, like, if you were to, say, cut somebody with a knife and then you were to heat up that knife, then the person would feel the burning of the wound. Things of that nature. Things that are almost what a modern mind would think of as like a quantum entanglement between two objects.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Exists within the confines of sympathetic magic.
Yeah.
Things, objects becoming tainted, objects becoming haunted, objects made holy through contact with, really important people. The whole, I'll never wash this hand again because
Right.
His hand has come into contact with Brad Pitt's face or something.
Well, and if I believed in voodoo or sorcery, like I would probably take care to deposit my fingernail clippings in a way in which I didn't want someone else to get them, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's old magic too.
Yeah, to use
hide your fingernail clippings, hide your hair, because these are parts of you. Well, these are even more, like, this is an even easier thing to buy, I think, because these were actually a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
These things were once my body. And now they are, you know, hidden away in the wall of the house, lest a sorcerer get a hold of it
right.
and use it to place a curse on me.
Or to make a nail clipping sculpture of me
right.
and then drive pins into me.
Exactly.
That's my fear.
And real quick.
It would only take 90 years of nail clippings.
And real quick, another idea that's tied up. You mentioned voodoo. And of course, that instantly brings to mind the idea of the voodoo doll. And you see variations on this theme in numerous magical and religious practices where you have a semblance of something.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can hurt the doll to hurt the person that the doll resembles, or if I burn somebody in effigy, I am,
right.
And you know, this is something you see in everything from Guy Fawkes Day to Burning Man,
mm-hmm.
you know, where an effigy is burned, and by burning the effigy, you are on some level hurting the person or the idea or feeling or thing that
yeah.
it represents.
Oh, we see this in political rallies all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And this comes down to something called the law of similarity, which holds that humans inevitably link superficial real-life resemblances to deep, unreal resemblances.
Okay, so I think about this in terms of the TED.com talk that you sent me. It's by skeptic Michael Shermer.
Ah.
And he was talking about... he's using examples of how we can't help to ascribe meaning or see patterns. And he brought up the case of the Virgin Mary visage on the grilled cheese.
The Virgin Mary grilled cheese.
Yeah, yeah. And he was saying that, you know, we've got this really sort of grainy pattern recognition in our brains. And so we really respond well to, like, you know, an image on tree bark or a burnt grilled cheese sandwich. All of a sudden, some of those grainy markings start to take form into an image.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's really fascinating, particularly when he pointed out that if you really look at that grilled cheese sandwich, it looks more like Jane Russell than it does the Virgin Mary.
Huh.
Because she's got very pouty lips.
Well, it comes down to the same reason we can just stare up into the sky at the clouds and just see one object after another. Oh,
yeah.
It's a dragon using a typewriter. It's Laurel and Hardy making out on a steamboat. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, except for that last part.
Well, I'm just saying, you see random things that may or may not make sense in the clouds.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the perceiver, right?
Right.
And we talked about this a little bit in Science of Lucky Pants, that some people may be more hardwired than others to see connections. In a Sandra Hubscher article about the dopamine connection, neurobiologist Peter Brueger found that people with high levels of dopamine are more likely to find significance in coincidences and pick out meaning and patterns where there are none. In one trial in which skeptics and paranormal believers were both given the drug L-DOPA, which, of course,
yeah.
I know, it sounds like a street.
L-DOPA.
L-DOPA increases dopamine levels in the brain. The skeptics began to perform much more like the believers.
Yeah, you sent me an interesting paper that discussed some of the ideas about, like, why ritual is important.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does it accomplish? And when we say ritual, I mean, on one hand, we could be talking about witches going out into the middle of nowhere on the Sabbath and gathering together for dance or whatever.
Right.
Or you could be just talking about a local church coming together and engaging in song, just like a glee club engaging in song, you
mm-hmm.
know, different communal activities, a community service group coming together and picking up trash around a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, that kind of thing can, under certain definitions, be seen as ritual.
Yeah, yeah. They are saying that these synchrony rituals are really powerful, and so much so that they may have endowed certain groups with a competitive advantage over the eon, perhaps even causing some cultures to flourish while others perish. That's from the article that I thought, well, that makes sense why we would have these rituals that we participate in. And in that article, they even brought up the observation that in modern day military, things like marching in formation or
muscular bonding, right?
Muscular bonding, yeah. And even chanting or, you know, the songs.
I don't know what I've been told.
Yeah.
That was the name of that one, right?
Yeah. I don't know what I've been told. Yeah. And I don't know the rest.
The rest varies depending on who's singing it, I think.
Yeah. Something about mamas and boots.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Clearly I have a vast knowledge of military songs. But in any case, what they were saying is that, you know, we still engage in these rituals, even though warfare is not conducted in, you know, here's one side in a formation of rows against another formation of rows that meet on a hilltop.
Right, you know? That old school version of a very, you know, regimented forces meeting on a battlefield and
marching into place,
basically playing out like a tabletop game.
Yeah,
that does not exist anymore. It hasn't existed in a while. But a lot of these activities still exist because it builds this bond.
Mm-hmm.
It builds this this cohesive feeling that we are one. You know, it's like that idea you see in every boot camp movie ever, that these guys enter as this ragtag group of miscreants, and then they over the course of the boot camp they become a fighting force together. They become brothers.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, through the experience, they're transformed into this super group, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting, particularly in the context of magical thinking. And this was from an article, Do You Believe in Magic? And it was saying that rituals and magical thinking give us a margin of control over the randomness in our lives. This is from the article. It says, magical thinking is most evident precisely when people feel most helpless. Giori Kinnan, a professor at Tel Aviv University, sent questionnaires to 174 Israelis after the Iraqi Scud missile attacks of 1991. Those who reported the highest level of stress were also the most likely to endorse magical beliefs, like, I have the feeling that the chances of being hit during a missile attack are greater if a person whose house was attacked is present in the sealed room. Or, to be on the safe side, it is best to step into the sealed room right foot first.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it can come down to you're faced with overwhelming odds or some sort of situation that you just cannot control. And it comes down to, what can I do? I can't actually stop this thing. Take the instance of death. When death comes, there's like nothing you can do to bring that person back.
Right.
But you can go and pray about it. You can go and light a candle about it. You can go and engage in various rituals,
mm-hmm.
even if that ritual is just something as simple as a meditation type
right.
of thing. And it's something you can do. And so there's this feeling of, I am doing something in the face of this uncontrollable force in my life.
Well, and it's been brought up before too, that ritual healing practices aren't too far away from like the placebo effect. Right,
right. Right. Yeah.
Like if you engage in this thing, you take the sugar pill, then all of a sudden your body is going to respond as if it's actually being treated, very much the same in a ritual scenario.
Another idea that came across in one of the links you sent me, and this comes from Stanford University psychologist and graduate student Scott S. Viltermuth. And the idea is that all this, this synchronicity, this movement and sound in a communal ritual, it really comes down to economic benefit, with the primary goal of being to spot the freeloader.
Yes, to ferret out the person who's not really contributing, really.
Right, right. So it's kind of like, all right, we're all going to do a big, giant square dance. And you can tell that the guy who's totally not into it is totally not into being a part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you can't trust him as much, him or her. You can't trust them. You can't rely on them. You know that in the end, or you can suspect in the end, they're going to be looking out for number one rather than the whole
right.
of the group.
They're not entering into the social contract.
Right.
Which I think is fascinating, right? I mean, yeah. This was particularly important back in the days, obviously when people got together in a more, I don't know, how would you say it? Just a more formal way or more intentional way, right? Because if you lived 2 miles, 5 miles from another family, then you really had to make a concerted effort to get together socially.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of us have been in situations where there's like some sort of a group activity that's happening with work.
Mm-hmm.
And you maybe don't really want to go to it, or you've got other things that need to be done, but you feel like you should. And part of that is because, yeah, it's like the people who don't show up, or the people who show up and are really obviously not into it.
Mm-hmm.
Can they be trusted? Are they really a part of the group, or are they freeloaders?
Well, and then also they're kind of wearing a little bit of jerk perfume.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to look like a jerk.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to Erica Jung. She talks about this in her foreword, that ritual intention counts for everything. It must be positive. And the more witches there are sitting in a circle practicing communal intention, the more potency the magic will have. Okay, so that's the other part of it, right? Like,
right.
if not that person's not participating, then they're weakening what the group effort is. The desire for magic cannot be eradicated. Even the most supposedly rational people attempt to practice magic in love and war. We simultaneously possess the most primitive of brain stems and the most sophisticated of cortexes. The imperatives of each coexist uneasily.
Huh. That reminds me a little bit of this bit that I ran across in this book, The Faust Myth, Religion and the Rise of Representation by David Hawkes. And he points out that magical thinking, first and foremost, it makes perfect sense in, to borrow a phrase from William Manchester, a world lit only by fire. If you live in a world with a lot of magical beliefs, mm-hmm. it pays to believe in magic because that is the currency
of ideas.
Yeah. All right. But by the 18th century, most modern Europeans are convinced that magic doesn't exist anymore. And you see witches and wizards and warlocks, you see them prosecuted not as blaspheming monsters or dangerous idea dealers, but rather as charlatans and frauds, mm-hmm. Especially in the colonies. And then Hawkes points out, and I'm going to read a quotation here. He says, by the end of the 20th century, however, this process of enlightenment had been subjected to such cogent philosophical and political critiques that few people would endorse it unequivocally. We are much more conscious than our forebears of the complicity between reason and magic. And many would argue that the postmodern era, with its virtual reality, its faith in the image, its electronic money, its new age religions, is witnessing a return to the kinds of overtly magical thinking that imperialism unsuccessfully tried to stomp out in the Southern Hemisphere.
Huh.
Which I found really interesting. Because indeed, there are all these, like electronic money is this unreal thing. I mean, the internet itself is kind of this, you know, where is the internet, right?
Well, I guess it depends quite a bit on our ability to think magically, right? Think metaphorically. So perhaps that's the reason why it hasn't been done away with by evolution, right? Because there are some people who say, why do we even have magical thinking anymore when we have the ability, even as tiny babies, to innately understand physics or math or language and what is real and what is not real? You know, kids by the age of 6 or 7 have a really great idea of what is real. And they usually, let, you know, Santa Claus or Easter Bunny or anything else, all those myths fall away. That being said, why do we keep holding on to it? And perhaps that's a reason why.
Well, one more thing about all this before we close out the podcast. And that's we were talking about, witches meeting for these Sabbaths. And I keep running across the image by Francesca de Goya, the Witch's Sabbath and the Great He-Goat,
mm-hmm.
which is this lovely image. I mean, Goya was awesome. And so it's all these women and they're arranged in like a big semicircle,
mm-hmm.
Around this speaker.
Like a harem.
Like a harem, yeah. And there's somebody playing the accordion, which I thought was a nice touch,
mm-hmm.
there with presumably Satan, the Great He-Goat, this sort of goat figure. And in many of the old woodcuts, I love looking at old woodcuts of witches and warlocks and all that. And the goat is often depicted as really, really raunchy and gross. And, you know, he's really deplorable looking. And it's like, oh, these women are gathering to worship and lay with the horned one. And he's so gross and vile. But in this image, the great he-goat seems to, inspire some of the more sympathetic aspects of a goat, for starters. And also this kind of, he seems like a wise old man. And these ladies are, I can't really judge him for going on here and what he has to say. That's a goat that looks like has wisdom.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting take. But I still prefer the red-hued beast as depicted in South Park.
Oh, and
who was very much in touch with his feelings,
yeah,
by the way.
And you, I think you like the one from Legend, right? The one
I do.
Tim Curry.
I do.
I'm kind of partial to the one Ernest Borgnine played in The Devil's Reign,
mm.
which had a cameo by Anton LaVey of the Church of Satan. But Ernest Borgnine turns into this man-goat creature, and it's pretty awesome.
I just can't imagine Ernest Borgnine as Satan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But real quick, this was a Halloween episode. You didn't explain your costume.
Oh, well, because you're supposed to intuit what it is.
You're a witch?
Yes.
Ah, excellent.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Should have brought a broom.
Yeah, broom would have been good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, of course, am dressed as the great he-goat, thus the goatee and the horns.
I got that.
Yeah. And these filthy hands. Ugh. But anyway.
And you look very wise, by the way.
Well, thank you. I would prefer to be the wise he-goat than the just deplorable, wretched he-goat.
Yeah. Thank you for not painting your body in red.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't get up in time this morning. You know how it is.
I know.
Well, let me reach into the cauldron of listeners' mail and poke around amongst the embers and the
thoughts,
the wolf teeth and the mummy wrappings and sea shark eggs. And let me see what we have to read. First of all, we heard from our listener Ian on Facebook, and he was responding to our recent episode about the orgasm wars, evolution of the orgasm. And he says, hey guys, love the podcast. Not to get too nitpicky, but sexual health, this is a subject that I have a great interest in. And I feel it necessary to report on a couple of errors in this episode. First, and I think most importantly, you repeatedly stated the male orgasm is required for pregnancy. This isn't entirely true. The pre-seminal fluid that is produced by the male organ for lubrication also contains enough sperm to cause a pregnancy. Thus, the reason that the pull-out method of birth control is not reliable. Unfortunately, this misconception is all too often repeated, and in this day and age of teen pregnancy, people really need to know that male orgasm does not need to occur to cause pregnancy. And then he initially forgets his second thing, but then he points out that clitoris is acceptable pronounced either way. So
clitoris or yeah, clitoris?
You said clitoris. I said clitoris.
I said let's call the whole thing off.
I freaked out and thought that I was saying it wrong and thought that clitoris sounded like a wizard's name.
Yeah, I didn't realize you could say clitoris. To me, though, that sounds like a great aunt clitoris or something.
Yeah.
Which, there could be a great aunt clitoris.
But back to Ian's first point about the presence of sperm and pre-seminal fluid. Looking around, it looks like there are different studies that go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
There are some that are saying, yeah, there's definitely, in some cases, sperm in this fluid. Other instances you see people saying, oh, it's almost never there. So, I don't know. There seems to be a lot of literature either way.
Yeah.
Certainly, it would behoove one to be careful.
To take caution. In fact, there's a Scrubs episode, I believe. Is his name John? The main character, he impregnates his girlfriend without actually having sex with her, based on what you just described there.
Ah, okay.
And I'm not going to go into detail, but...
No spoilers, yep. Right?
No.
Okay. And we also heard from our listener, Thor, from Sweden. Even if he didn't have anything to say, I would have to mention that we have a listener named Thor in Sweden.
Just pretty awesome.
Yeah. And he says, hey guys, so I just listened to the podcast on lies. An idea struck me when you were talking about the aliens who couldn't lie. And I think I may have been referring to China Mielville's embassy town. And that he says, if you can't lie, are you then all-knowing? Example, someone asks you, what are the first 15 decimals of pi? You start by saying, well, 3.1415. If you can't lie, you have to keep going. So does the inability to lie make you know the 15 decimals? Maybe a bad example, but you get the idea. Another thing, if you were told when you were a kid that watching TV too close makes your eyes square and nobody's ever told you that it isn't true, is saying it then a lie? Thanks for a lot of very interesting stuff. Smiley face, love from Sweden, Thor.
All right, yeah. I don't think that if you've not been disabused from the idea, then I don't think that it's lying.
Right. Yeah. What it instantly makes me think of, too, is we discussed this in the False Memory podcast. It's about how you can have a memory that is false.
Mm-hmm.
And you saying it, you think it's true. But on a deeper cognitive level, brain scans reveal that you might know, the brain may know that you are lying. And I find that, and that's just, I just find that an interesting idea, especially in relation to this. The idea that even as we believe something, it doesn't mean that we believe it in the deeper levels of the brain.
I also think it's fascinating that in Sweden, perhaps, maybe this is a cultural thing, that the myth is that if you sit too close to the TV, your eyes will turn into squares, as opposed to in the United States, if you sit too close to the TV, you'll go blind.
Oh, I didn't notice. I guess that's the thing. I read this, and I was just instantly thinking about our idea. Make your eyes square. Square-eyed? What is square-eyed?
I don't know. Maybe turn your round eyes into, like, the actual...
into actual squares?
The iris into squares, which would be kind of cool.
Huh. We may have lost something in translation there. But anyway, I love getting email that says, love from Sweden, Thor. So hopefully,
yeah.
hopefully we'll get more of that from other people with
even if you don't live in Sweden.
Yes, yeah. So, if you would like to share some ideas with us, if you would like to provide feedback on a podcast episode, present ideas for future episodes, you can find us on Facebook and you can find us on Twitter. And on both of those, we go by the moniker Below the Mind. And also, you can just search for Stuff to Blow Your Mind, Facebook, Twitter, and you'll probably find us.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Tenor girl goes shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.